It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. My guest today is one of Alaska's greatest mountaineers, Vern Tejas. Vern was the first to climb Denali solo in the winter and survive. And we'll hear that story and the unique role played by our public radio station in his success, and his many other firsts to his name. He has climbed the 10 highest mountains on each of the seven continents at least 10 times, including doing the seven faster than anyone else. He's also climbed Denali more times than anyone else. A lot of records. But what will impress you about Vern is what a warm guy he is and his healthy philosophy about climbing, which probably helps explain his success and survival. He knows that getting down the mountain is more important than getting up. We'll be talking about that and his new book, 70 Summits, Life in the Mountains, which he wrote with Lou Friedman. Well, Vern is with me right now in the studio. I'm so excited to have been following his career for all these many years and just gotten to meet him. And he's kind of been a celebrity here in the radio station as people are remembering his exploits. Vern has, as I said, done so many firsts. But the one that I think that Alaskans are proudest of and talk most about is first ascent of Denali. And this was back in 1988. And one of the world's great climbers, Naomi Hiramura, if I said it right?
Yes, that's correct.
He had he died trying to do this. And you were then inspired to try to follow in his footsteps and succeed. Tell me about this, the reason why you decided to do that climb and the impact that he had on you.
It was 1984 when he disappeared. He actually made it to the top but didn't come back down. Mm. And I was starting a year-long travel around the world. And first stop was in Japan. And while I was there, I visited one of my heroes who was on the first winter ascent. A book was written about it called Minus 148, mm-hmm. Art Davison.
We've had Art on the show before, yeah.
Art's one of my favorite heroes. And one of the other team members was Shiro Naimishi. And while I was in Japan, I wanted to look him up just because of the climbing connection with Alaska. And I was actually staying at his house when the public realized that that Naomi was dead and would never come back. Mm. And Shiro, because he had climbed in the winter, was a key person for the media to interview. So we had many people trying
to... Hiramura, he was a big national hero in Japan. I mean, this is not like some unknown person disappearing.
Yeah, I mean, he's not well known in the States, mm-hmm. but over there, he actually popularized adventure travel for so many Japanese. He did it solo, which is not typical, and then wrote about it and had these great adventures. He was the first person to ever go to the North Pole solo. He also built a raft in South America and floated all the way down the Amazon. So he had this tradition of taking on very difficult expeditions. First man to actually solo in the summertime on Denali.
Hmm.
So he got around. He disappeared. The media beat a path to Shiro's door, and I was there and enveloped in this whole national mourning for Naomi, which to me said so much that a lone individual climber could actually impact the psyche of a country.
Yeah.
In particular, I remember one time a very old Japanese woman grabbed me by my lapels and pulled me down to her face and said, "Where is Naomi?"
Oh my gosh.
And for me, I said, like, wow, he touched so many people. Mm-hmm. Even little old ladies are affected by his stories of climbing, and he had effect beyond the mountains. He inspired many, many people. And at that point, I was just like, wow, that says a lot about what climbing can be for other people.
Yeah.
So I think they kind of set the hook. 2 years later, Dave Johnston, who had been on that original minus 148 climb of the mountain, had actually lost toes and spent a horrible week with Regine, mm-hmm. and Art Davison, survived that. They had become my heroes. But at that point, I had become friends with Dave, and he was thinking about going out and trying it in the wintertime, solo, inspired by Naomi. And we had lots to talk about, because I was now guiding frequently on Denali, and he was asking me for beta, you know, where the crevasses mm-hmm. are, what kind of gear I would use. And I ended up giving him some details and some equipment, which he went on to use. In his attempt, he actually skied in from his cabin. It must have been about 30 miles.
Wow.
Up to Denali. And
no plane ride to the Kehalton Glacier.
No, but he couldn't really because he had a bridging device for the crevasses that was, I think it was like 18 feet long. I mean, it's a huge thing. But it kept him safe. He didn't fall in any crevasses. However, when he was at about 12,500 feet, he got be stormed, if you will. And in the process of digging in and the wind blowing snow, he got buried in his snow structure and probably would have suffocated if it hadn't been for being woken up by footsteps. He heard footsteps. It's the middle of winter on Denali.
Who the hell could be there?
And he said, it woke me right up. Then I realized I was suffocating because the door was blown over and the breathing hole was blown over in my snow cave. And at that point, he couldn't get out the door, so he went right through the roof, looked around. There was nobody there, and he spent the rest of the evening trying to fill back in his snow cave. In the process, re-injured his frostbite areas and decided it wasn't worth going for the summit, mm-hmm. at least at this point. So he returned. But after he returned, I realized, wow, he didn't do it. Naomi theoretically got to the top and never came back. So here's one of the great challenges of my day was to be a solo climber.
Nobody knew if it could really be done and survive. And this is one of the things that in reading your book impressed me is that whatever it was, for you, the challenge was the thing that was the most difficult, the thing that nobody else could do or whatever, just being the first, being the best. I mean, you have this amazing drive, and that was part of this need to climb Denali, wasn't it?
I do have a competitive streak in me, but I think more than being first, it was, can I do that? Mm-hmm. You know, if this Japanese guy did it and Dave turned back on it and he's one of my heroes, it's kind of like it would be the ultimate test.
Yeah.
And for me, I like a challenge, and this is a great personal challenge.
But you're thinking about two of your heroes, two of the people you admire the most, and you're thinking, could I do something they didn't do? I just find that's powerful.
I think that's, we all stand on the shoulders
absolutely.
Of those who precede us. And, uh-huh. Certainly his doing it solo in the winter made me think, oh, it was possible. I mean, at that point, mm-hmm. it was impossible that a soloist could do it. And then, actually knowing enough information and having the right equipment that I could, speak to Dave and loan some gear to him, made me realize like, hey, maybe I've got the ability to do something this challenging.
Yeah. So we were talking before starting that, and this is perfect for public radio, is that before you took off, you actually upped your public radio membership in this station, KSKA, and you got a little prize for that, which turned out to be really valuable to you. Fill folks in on that, because I love that.
Well, first I'd like to say I'm an avid listener to KSKA.
Great,
It has been one of my great joys of living in Alaska is having a very personalized radio that teaches me about the world, and it's a great thing. So I contributed, made my donation for that year, and I received a small transistor radio. It was just the right size for taking up on Denali. It just had a couple of AA batteries in it. And because Denali's so high, it's like being on the highest antenna in North America. So I could actually receive radio broadcasts from right here. I could get it from different places around the state as well. And I would listen to the weather, and I'd listen to Radio Reader, and mm-hmm. I'd listen to the news. But the weather in particular, because of all the affiliate stations, I got a really big mosaic picture of the state.
Oh,
and I
neat.
Knew what was going on, what the temperatures were, when the winds were coming. Every time you'd say, there's wind on the hillside in Anchorage, I knew I was going to get blasted the next day.
Right.
And so it became a very elaborate way to get accurate weather.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it also gave me the ability to listen in when you guys were having an interview with my pilot, the Lowell Thomas Jr.
And just to set this up, nobody knew, you were overdue. And we want to go back and fill in that part of the story, but nobody knew if you were alive, right? And people were writing about you in the newspaper. Lou Friedman, your co-author in the book, is writing about, like, where is Vern Tejas? Is he gone the way of Nomura? You know, is he gone? And so, but you're still listening up there.
Yes. The only real way that anybody knew I was alive was on my summit day. I radioed out on the CB radio and asked somebody to get a message to my pilot, and they did. And Lowell Thomas Jr. flew his plane up there so he could talk to me personally. Mm-hmm. And I heard his plane flying around. I turned on my CB, and he said, "Did you make it?" I said, "Yes, I'm on my way down." He says, "Good, hurry up because there's a big storm coming." Uh-huh. And that, you know, he said, in a couple of days, I think 3 days. But anyway, like the weather so often is, it comes in hard and fast, especially mm-hmm. on the top of North America. So it came in early. I got pinned down. I was out of food. I was in a snow cave hoping that the storm would go away someday. So after a couple of days in there, I was listening to the news, and I was listening to KSKA, and you guys just happened to be interviewing Lowell Thomas Jr., and right. I was like, got to listen. It was like he was having a conversation with me.
They're saying, how's Vern Tejas doing?
Like, where do you think Vern is? Well, I believe he's in Kehltna Pass. He's probably pinned down in the storm. And I'm going, yes, I'm in Kehltna Pass, and I am pinned down by the storm. And we believe he's running low on food. I've got one candy bar left, and I'm staying here until the storm's over. But then he said something that was really important, which he said he left his survival rations at base camp. And that's many miles away, and during a storm, I would never even conceive of going down there. But along with that, he had fuel that he left for me, and he put a red flag on it. And so now I had some reason to leave the snow cave and to get down. So I actually left in the storm and worked my way down the glacier. Fortunately, as I got lower on the mountain, the winds slowed down, and I was able to make it to base camp and to enjoy food and fuel once again.
You heard it here, folks. This is why you should make your contribution to public radio. It may save your life.
I'm forever grateful that I had made this contribution. Yeah.
Vern Tejas is my guest today on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Vern's new book, which he did with Lou Friedman, is 70 Summits, Life in the Mountains. It's available around town. And Vern, as you're hearing, is one of our great heroes of Alaska climbing and worldwide, has done some incredible firsts. And so we're just honored to have him on the show today. So what was the hardest part of that Denali climb, that winter climb? Was it this getting stuck in the storm on the way down? Or because we always think maybe there's some key that he figured out that nobody else did. Was that the case, or were you just, tough and lucky and everything else?
Well, definitely there's some luck involved, Charles. But I think the big thing is the psychological strain of knowing that you're solo in a crevassed area, and it's very often frequently white out. There's no trail because it's wintertime, and you have to navigate where you can't see. I mean, these crevasses get bridged over lightly. It's
right.
Like a trap door. If you step on it, you drop through. So psychologically, to steel myself for that this is the biggest component. I like to say that climbing is 60% physical and 80% mental. Mm-hmm. And that'll give you an idea of how important that mental factor is. It's hugely physical.
You grow up to 140%, yeah.
It's hugely physical, but without having the self-discipline, the drive, the ability to make yourself get up in the middle of the night when the storm is ripping your shelter apart, if you can't do that, if you can't get out of your warm sleeping bag, you're a dead man walking.
Yeah.
So for me, the mental aspect is probably the biggest thing, and that's why I took that aluminum ladder with me.
Right, the ladder that you used to get across all those crevasses and keep yourself safe.
Yeah, it was actually, I wore it all the way up to 14,000 feet, so it was physically, it was a detriment. I had 18 pounds of ladder, but at the same time, I couldn't go forward without knowing that my next step was, if my next step killed me, I couldn't have taken it.
Right.
So with the ladder, I felt like at least I have a second chance. I have a fighting chance of dealing with crevasses on their own terms. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of that component of, that's the big challenge for me. Once I came up with a way to psychologically steel myself, then you're just dealing with, 50, 60 below weather, frostbite, lots of dark. You know, it's a lot of work.
But you say this, the ladder was a psychological tool, but it was also a physical tool, right?
Yeah. I mean, had I actually dropped in a crevasse, I would have then had to weasel my way out of my harness and then crawl across the ladder to safety and then pull everything across to the other side, which it was hooked to my sled. Mm-hmm. So it actually had a dual function.
Right.
It actually triple in the fact that I'd use it when I made my snow trench. I would put the ladder over the top of it and then my ski poles and skis and then drape a tarp over the whole thing and then bury it in a foot of snow.
A lot of good ideas. Do you still have the ladder?
I do.
Yeah, never getting rid of
it's
that.
It's up in Tall Keaton. You know, it's great for clearing gutters and things.
That seems like that's your security blanket, right? It got you through. Yeah. So I've been interested in this psychological component because I think that we think of that as being something you're born with or not. But in reading the book, I realized that maybe not. You kind of learned it a little bit. It's on the very first time you were on Denali on a guided trip, you're learning to climb it the first time. You kind of go out fast like a kid in a foot race and you wear yourself out and then you're ready to quit and go home and you get talked out of it. Was that a really big moment for you in terms of figuring out like, what is this all about?
I was 5 years in the making for Denali. Mm-hmm. I saw it when I first came to the state as a 19-year-old, saw it in all of its glory, set the hook. I said, I'm going to climb this thing. I spent 5 years in the Chugach and the Tall Keetnas and down on the Kenai, just running up and down every mountain I could, learning about crevasses, avalanches, frostbite, how to start a stove in the cold, how to, you know, dry out when you're wet in the cold. So when I get to the mountain, I've got all this energy. I've been training for 5 years and I bust like a racehorse out of the gate and picked up the biggest load I could. And worked really hard all day long and didn't take care of myself. I got dehydrated, I got sunburned, I got AMS, is acute mountain sickness from mm-hmm. working too hard. And we get back to base camp that night and I'm shot. And I go to my guide, Jim Hale, a local guide here from Anchorage. And I said, Jim, I'm not up for this. I feel like hell. And he said, well, you know, don't judge from how you feel right now. Don't fly out right now. Let's wait till the morning. See how you feel in the morning. And if you really want to go back, you can. But I think you overdid it today, and I could have told you you're going to, but this is better. You learned it the hard way. And yeah, he was right. I stayed the night. The next morning, I felt better, put on the sun cream, made sure I drank a lot of liquids, and I paced back. I didn't grab the biggest load. And in the process, had a good day and followed by another good day. Found out that I was a slow acclimatizer, but we were doing the traverse, which is from one side of the mountain to the other side. In doing so, you have to take more equipment and more food.
In other words, you're going up on the well-known West Buttress, but you're coming down the other side of the mountain.
Yes, going out the Muldrow. Mm-hmm. So up and over Denali Pass, which is really high. Most people these days only go to 17.2, whereas Denali Pass is another 1,000 feet above. And that means not only do you have to carry all your equipment up there, but all your garbage that you've generated for the first 3 weeks of climbing has to go up and over as well. Anyway, it takes more time. More time is actually better with altitude. So my body was able to adapt. And by the time summit day rolled around, I was in very good condition. And we summited from the Denali Pass, which is at 18,200 feet, up and back, and still felt like I had, you know, I had some oofta left. Mm-hmm. And later on, a couple hours after we got back and had lunch, Jim says, hey, anybody want to do the North Summit? And I was like, man, I'm up for it. So he and I waltzed over there and actually got to look down that same face that I'd seen 5 years earlier. It was one of the highlights of my life and probably set the hook.
You'd seen it from below and now you're seeing it from above, like a 14,000 foot
Face.
It must be one of the biggest cliffs in the world.
The only thing that I know that exceeds it is on Nanga Parbat. So that's over in Pakistan, in the Himalayas, the highest range in the world. This is right here in our state. Huge uplift and impressive from both the bottom and the top looking down it.
Yeah. Now, you've climbed Denali more times than any other person.
That is correct, 57, but who's keeping track?
And yeah, it's like, I feel like you must know every inch of that mountain by now. Does it still surprise you?
It's, yeah. People ask you, well, how can you keep doing the same thing over and over? Actually, I think now it's more about the people. Every trip's different because I have different climbers. And I learned so much when I came to Alaska from mentors, from the people who knew the old timers. You know, I gleaned so much that they gave so freely of their information and time to a young cowboy from Texas. I feel that now it's my obligation, moral responsibility, really to share what they shared with me so freely and give it back to the people that I climb with.
That was an interesting insight in the book for me, is when you're first learning to guide and your first client was somebody I knew, Dave Walsh, who was on the assembly here in Anchorage, ran for mayor, a great guy, never thought of him as being a mountain climber. You ended up being sort of called in unexpectedly to guide him on that climb, and you kind of learned something about guiding, about how to do it, right?
Sure. I mean, I learned a little bit about not going too fast at the beginning. But
kind of wore him out.
I learned with my co-guide, he was also on that same climb, that once you go to altitude, you become acclimatized. And if you're guiding somebody who's not acclimatized, you really need to be conservative.
Right.
So we ran Dave up that hill. I didn't know that at the time. And you know, we could have killed him. But he was a real trooper. And we got to the top. Came back down, had some issues descending, but ultimately I thought, you know, what a weak guy.
You know? And it sounds like you got pretty harsh with him too.
JD actually picked him up by the lapel and said, if you slip off the trail one more time, I'm gonna personally come back here and kill you. Anyway, but it woke him up. Mm-hmm. It cut through the haze, mental haze of hypoxia, and Dave stayed on the trail after that, which saved our life. But in retrospect, I realized that I had been way too harsh. It wasn't that he was out of shape. It was that we were in magnificent shape from having climbed it just 2 weeks earlier. So we didn't give him the benefit of the doubt. We climbed it in 11 days. Nobody climbs it that fast these times. I mean, that's just crazy. So I learned to go slow with people. And this has been one of the big reasons I'm so successful, is once you learn to be conservative, go slow, let people adapt, you're going to have higher success.
You're kind of being smarter about it rather than just being tougher about it.
It was a good lesson to learn in my first guided trip up there.
So you've been a guide for so many years now, and you've guided so many climbs. The title of the book, 70 Summits, is referring to the fact that you've done the seven summits 10 times, which is amazing, right?
At least. I mean, that's the minimal amount. Everest I've only done 10 times. And believe it or not, Kosciuszko in Australia I've only done
10 times. Because that's just a little hill, right?
It's a little hill, but it's a long ways to go just for a little hill.
And for those who don't know, the seven summits are the highest mountains of each of the seven continents.
Correct.
Which is something nobody had even done until the 1980s.
That is correct. And I was inspired by that. And Harry Johnson latched right onto it. He read the book and says, we need to do this. And so that's when we started branching out and going international.
And this, for in terms of your career, this made it so that you could be a year-round full-time mountain climber, right? Because when you're just working here in Alaska, it's only a few months.
It's seasonal.
So
people don't want a guide for the wintertime up there. Nobody goes up there.
Right.
But then all of a sudden, Aconcagua in South America, great. I can do that in November, December, January. I mean, it opens up a whole other world. Anything in the Southern Hemisphere. So from there, I started going international. It just happened right after that. I think once I climbed in the winter solo, my name was in circulation among climbing circles, and I got offers to, hey, do you want to go to Russia to climb? Do you want to go to Antarctica to climb? And I was very lucky. Some of my early climbers on the mountain wanted to do the seven summits, and they basically took me with them. I was their personal guide, and that got me started very early, ground zero. I was, I think, the 16th person in the world to do the seven summits, and probably the first person to get paid to do them.
Really?
So I was the first person to guide them. And
you've got a number of other, I mean, you've done them faster than anyone else. I mean, you've done a whole bunch. These records are great. I mean, they're amazing. How important are the records to you personally?
The records are just made to be broken, really, but they're fun. It's a way of challenging yourself at a level that you know is like, you know, the best in the world has just did it in, you know, 165 days. If I do it in 145 days, you know, I'm that much stronger, more mm-hmm. adept, or lucky, who knows. Mm-hmm. But it's a way of keeping track of where you are. And, one of the things that it's not all about physicality. I actually have been the first person to carry a guitar to the top of each continent. So there's all sorts of records out there. But that's one of my favorite things, is to mix business with pleasure. I always try to take a musical instrument with mm-hmm. me when I go to the mountains.
I was enjoying that part, and it told me something about your work as a guide and why you're so successful, is because it's not just that you're the toughest, it's not just you can climb the most mountains, but also that people want to go with you, and you make it fun to the extent you can. Obviously, there's some pain involved in climbing big mountains, and sometimes you take a guitar, and sometimes you take a harmonica, and what's that all about? It's just sort of keeping it light and keeping people in a good mood?
I think, you have storm days come in, mm-hmm. you have days when, it's really hard. If you can lighten the whole ambiance of the team, that's a bonus. I was very fortunate. Jim Hale had a very high fun factor in his guiding style, and I was able to pick up on that. And I realized, it's not all about challenge and making, roughing it. It's really about enjoying it. And for me,
why do it otherwise? Yeah.
If you're not having fun, you're making a mistake. And mm-hmm. I'm a very firm believer in the phrase that the best climber in the world is the one who's having the most fun. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I aspire to, is being the best guide possible. And it's not about just, topping out and, standing on the high point and doing your Rocky victory dance up mm-hmm. on top. It's about enjoyment. It's about smelling the roses, taking the photographs, enjoying the snowfall, and taking in these broad vistas that are available to us.
Incredibly beautiful up there, right?
It's one of the reasons I do it.
It's hard to even believe
it. It's for the beauty. It's certainly, I like challenge, but the beauty, the amazing people that I meet in the mountains, it doesn't attract people who aren't hard workers, who don't have ambition. It attracts people who are motivated, self-actuated, alpha type personalities. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest choices you can make is who you surround yourself with. And to be around these people, this is like a benefit of this kind of career, is to be around successful people who are doing amazing things.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a fraternity of climbers, and that there's a mutual respect that people develop in this world. And you kind of you know one another, and you know what you're capable of, partly by these accomplishments, right?
Yeah, and I think it means something to other people as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, so once I climbed Denali in the winter solo, then my name got broadcast around, and people wanted to climb with me, and that's really what set on fire my international guiding career. Mm-hmm. Once you get a little bit of renown, then they invite you to Russia. I was one of the first people from the West to climb in Russia on Elbrus, which is the highest mountain in Europe, and got invited to go to Antarctica in 1988. That's just 3 years after the first of the seven summiters summited. I mean, I was there that just so few years after he'd done it, that it was still in its infant stages. Now, after doing this, now been fortunate enough to climb it 39 times, the highest mountain, Vinson.
Wow.
It's known as, yeah. So, I mean, it's become more than a career. It's become a lifestyle for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to learn much more about Vern Tejas and his amazing resume of climbs and some more of his adventures. I want to learn about that first climb of Everest and so many other accomplishments that he's made. Vern is my guest today. I'm Charles Wolforth on Outdoor Explorer. Please stick with us. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and my guest today is Vern Tejas, the climber who is done so many firsts, so many great accomplishments for Alaskans. We think of his first ascent in the winter solo of Denali, but Vern has climbed the seven summits and the seven highest mountains of the seven continents 10 times. That is 10 times all of them. He's done many of them many more times. He's climbed Denali, Mount McKinley, more times than anybody alive. And he's got a new book with Lou Friedman called 70 Summits, Life in the Mountains, which talks, it's basically an autobiography covering many, many exploits. So thanks again for being here, Vern.
Oh, thank you very much, Charles. It's a pleasure.
So we talked a little bit about how you did your winter ascent of Denali after the death of Naomi Hiramura, who was a hero to you. And you did your first ascent, your personal first ascent of Everest after the death of Regine, who was kind of a controversial, huge figure in Alaska climbing.
One of the first professional mountain guides in Alaska.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah. So tell me about going to Everest. What was your, what was the story behind making that first climb for you? And you didn't make it the first time, right? I mean, you had to work at it.
Too many times, but. Yeah. So, yeah, very rare to succeed on your first try. So many things. Everest, certainly in those days, was much harder. It was my third attempt before I actually got to the top. But the way I got there was through my passion of climbing Denali and then testing myself in the wintertime solo. Name recognition was, running through the climbing world, if you will. And I got invited by Harry Johnson, who said, we should be doing the Seven Summits. I'd like you to come up there as a guide and work with me. And of course, I was immediately honored and flattered by his request, but also a little bit overwhelmed. I mean, I'd only climbed in Alaska. So I said, I agreed, and off we were going to go. Unfortunately, that was also the time of very low oil prices, and we were in recession here in Alaska. And Harry was in the real estate business. He did title insurance. And title insurance wasn't really great during those days. Everybody was selling their house, but, the values were plummeting, and a lot of people weren't. They're just locked up. They couldn't sell because they'd sell
foreclosed houses and
anyway,
all that. Yeah.
Business required him stay here. And so I got bounced up from being a mountain guide on Everest to being the climbing leader, which has got a lot more responsibility to it. And I had to gulp hard and decide whether or not I wanted that much responsibility.
When you've never even been on the mountain.
Never been there before. But having many trips on Denali and knowing how challenging Denali can be, I felt like the mountain had trained me enough that I could reasonably pull off a safe climb with paying customers. So off we went, and I was climbing leader.
Wow. Now, it's a bit different there, too, because you've got this whole culture of the Sherpas, and you're going over some terrain that is, historic as well as being, from what I've read, there's this culture of people who are supporting climbing there, and that's sort of their whole way of life. Tell me about that a little bit.
One of the most beautiful spots on Earth, and I think some of the most beautiful people, live in the Khumbu Valley, which is just south of Everest and Lhotse and Nupse and some of the highest points in the world. The mountain people are very hardworking people and people of faith, great faith, and the Sherpa are Buddhist, and everything they do radiates a joy and a happiness, and I've become quite enamored. Without Sherpa, I don't think the mountain would get climbed probably 1% of the times it is now. The Sherpa make it happen. Without them, most of us couldn't get to the top.
And these guys are just these incredible, incredible physical condition, incredible mountaineers, right?
They're not mountaineers when they start. You need to learn the skills. Mm-hmm. But they're working with a lot of fine material. They've got genetics that are impressive. They've been training since they were kids, running up and down the mountains or just the hills, just to go to the next town, which is at 15,000 feet.
Right.
I mean, that's higher than anything in the lower 48 right there.
Huge,
and they just run back and forth to go to school. Mm-hmm. And in the process, they become trained athletes without even realizing it. There's no wheeled transportation in the Khumbu. It's all on foot.
Wow.
So they start at a very young age. They carry everything they need to take to the next village. It's on their back, on their head, on their tump line. And in doing so, they train for carrying loads at altitude. And I was told, Sherpa, they're twice as strong and twice as fast as you'll ever be. And I was like, I don't believe that. And when I got over there, it made me a believer. These guys, not only are they stronger and faster than the best of the Western climbers, they also do it with a sense of grace and dignity and fun and joy. I mean, to me, you couldn't ask for better climbing companions.
How neat. So you mentioned that Everest was a harder climb in those days than it is now. And I mean, mountain's same size. What's changed?
I think our knowledge of the mountain, what we know is required to do it in good form, has changed. We used to just, throw brute force at it. Now we're much more finessed. We know exactly how much food is going to require. We take communications equipment so that people don't go crazy not being able to find out what's going on at home. Mm-hmm. We broadcast out to the friends and family back home, our progress so that they're not worried. So it's become a much much more transparent expedition, and people know what's going on. We're also able to, the helicopters, amazing development over the last 10 years. It's gone from one or two Soviet old aircraft to state-of-the-art highest flying helicopters in the world, and there's many of them. So it means that if you get sick, you can be transported out there immediately. Evacuations are not difficult to pull off these days. You still have weather to deal with, but as soon as the weather's clear, you can be gone.
And it's still a very inherently dangerous mountain, right?
Because,
there's no way to get around the danger.
Danger level actually might have gone up, but the risk of dying once you've gotten stranded at altitude has gone away in the fact that it's lower now because of the helicopter. The use of trained climbers to put in the ice fall route. There's a fixed line that goes through the ice fall. And over the course of years, several Sherpa have risen to the standard that they are skilled enough that they can put in all the hardware that's necessary to protect our pathway through the, I shouldn't say all, the pathway is a very dangerous path to begin with, but at least you won't be falling off it. Something could fall on you, but now you're not worried so much about falling in crevasses because you got a ladder to go across, you got hand ropes to help you across it. If you're clipped in, if something moves out from underneath you, you'll be dangling, which isn't great, but it's a lot better than the options.
Yeah.
So it's become safer on that level. But because of global warming, things are moving faster. Things that used to be in position are now moving. So there used to be a big hanging ice over the Khumbu Icefall. Some of that is definitely fallen off, I believe, due to the warmth. And just in 2014, killed some of my friends.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, so it's become, we've never seen that kind of destruction and loss of life until recently.
Until things started moving up there.
So that's,
and there's a lot more people up there too, right?
Yes, it's gone from a handful of groups when I first tried to go there, and I think it was 89. There was one other team on the route. Now,
and you mentioned that arriving at the peak, and you believe it's the first time there are two parties that converged on the peak.
In 92, it changed from just two teams on the route to half a dozen teams.
Hmm.
And of course, everybody wants to go on the best route, or in this case, the safest, easiest route, which our climbers, we owe that to them as good guides, and they want to go when there's good weather. So guess what happens? Everybody gets in position, we wait for good weather, and all the teams want to go on the same day.
And you're in a traffic jam.
And that's exactly what happened to me in 92. We ended up with 32 people waiting to get across the traverse from the South Summit to the True Summit. And we waited for an hour and a half as the team in front of us safely got their members across, but we're burning oxygen.
Right.
And oxygen's life at that altitude. And if you don't have very much of it, you can't wait around very long.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you never can carry enough up there.
And you actually ran out on the way down, right?
I did.
Yeah.
And probably would have not gotten down if it hadn't been for some other climbers sharing their bottle with me. So that's a risk that was never foreseen, but is something now that there's more traffic on the mountain, you have to understand that you could be a lot slower than intended.
How do you feel about that? Because, I mean, we think of this as being the wilderness, being utterly remote, and of being sort of, you know, the part about it being sort of your personal accomplishment. And then getting up there, and there's so many people, and I guess there's probably a lot of pollution from all those people, too. I mean, how does that affect your experience?
Well, as far as the traffic jam, that's can be avoided. There's lots of routes. Granted, they're harder and more dangerous than the easier, the standard route, as we call it. There's lots of different days you can go, but most people try to go at the first possible moment the weather's good once they get in position. And that all tends to crescendo on the same few days.
I see.
If you got a big weather window, you can spread out the crowds. But if it turns out to be a small weather window, everybody's trying to do it in 2 or 3 days. And when now you've got 1,000 people all jamming for the same time zone, same window of opportunity to get to the summit, it can make for big crowds. Interestingly enough, you can avoid that too by going on bad weather, you know, which adds a little bit of risk, but you know you're not going to get slowed down by the climbers in front of you. So my last trip up there was in 2013. We got 100% of our climbers to the summit, and we saw two other people the whole day. So no traffic, but we went on a day after the good weather was over. And so, you know, most everybody went the day before. There was bottlenecks. There was lots of problems. Mm-hmm. We went the day after. Just that was our strategy. We'll wait till worse weather, but less traffic.
Yeah.
And so we avoided that crush. Now, the pollution concerns is most people are, you know, they know how tenuous life is at that altitude, and they don't really think about, you know, leaving something behind. They don't want to stay behind themselves.
Right.
So it's get yourself down as soon as possible. However, what had happened was people were leaving their tents up. They were leaving food behind. They were leaving discarded oxygen bottles. And that became a real eyesore. And as a mountaineer who wants to go back and share these mountains with other people, I started realizing that we were our own problem. Mm-hmm. We need to clean up after ourselves. Fortunately, my company embraced the idea of let's have a deposit on the bottles, a return policy that when a Sherpa would bring down a bottle, or even one of the climbers, if they brought down a bottle, they'd get $10 a bottle. Mm-hmm. And if you bring down 5 bottles, that's $50. That's huge in a country where the average wage per day is $1.
Wow.
So these guys were really motivated, and the bottles started coming down. Mm-hmm. The garbage started getting cleaned up. And there's been several expeditions to the mountains that have been based on the concept of we're going to make a positive impact in the environment, and we're going to actually bring more stuff off the mountain than we take onto it.
That's right.
And so that's been happening for now 10 years, or maybe even longer, actually. Mid-90s is when that started, and the mountain is cleaner. Literally tons and tons of detritus and bottles and old climbing gear has come off that mountain. So I think it's easy for the press in particular. They like to take pot shots, you know, the world's hardest garbage dump. But actually, it's better now than it was.
That's good.
And some of that garbage is actually museum pieces. I remember finding a bottle from the Swiss expedition in 1952. And I also have, I brought down a bottle of my own from the British expedition in 1953.
Oh.
And it, you know, it has it stamped right in the bottle. I'm like, this is amazing to have this piece of history. So I've done my share of bringing some of that stuff down too.
It's Outdoor Explorer. Today, our guest is Vern Tejas. He's written 70 Summits, Life in the Mountains with Lou Friedman. And Vern, as you've heard, is probably got more records to his name than any other Alaskan alpinist, and really fortunate to have him on the show today. My name is Charles Woolforth. So, Vern, we mentioned that Ray Genet, who was this founder of Alaska mountain climbing, died on Everest, and you talk a little bit about how he had an attitude of summit or bust and just like go for it, and that's the goal. You're still here after this extraordinary career of so many mountains on so many continents. What is your secret to safety? I mean, obviously, you always want to cross your fingers because anything can go wrong, but you're still here and a lot of people aren't. And what is your attitude to safety, or how do you keep your party safe?
I think I kind of turned that philosophy around that Ray had. It's not the summit that's important. It's getting back down to the base camp that's important. Mm-hmm. Or I like to visualize celebrating in a bar. I'm not, actually, I don't drink. I don't partake of that. But that just the visualization of partying when you get down off the mountain is I think, the end goal. That's where the vision should lie. A lot of people get caught up in, like, the high point is the trip. And that's not. For me, the journey is the actual reason why I'd be there. The process is more important than the actual point. Mm-hmm. So coming back to celebrate is, you know, if you can't do that, you failed.
Which just means that you're thinking cautiously and you're prepared to sort of give up your goal, you know, where somebody else might be sort of still pushing onward because that's what they have in mind.
One of the things you learn here on Denali is conservative is rewarded. If the more times you make the right choice, maybe it doesn't get to the top. You say, look, there's so much snow here, obvious avalanche conditions. I'm not going to risk my people's lives on this. That earns you respect. And, you know, that
earns you more respect than being the guy who made it to the
top. When they realize that you made that choice, not for their egos, but for their safety, mm-hmm. they respect you. And other guides do too. They know how much pressure there is on performance. They know there's a push to get to the top. You probably get tipped better. Everybody feels elated. It's great publicity for your company. But you have to be conservative. And that's got to be forefront in your mind is, it's not getting to the top. It's getting everybody back down with no frostbite. That's success.
It's kind of long haul for you too as a career, right? Because, I mean, the fact you've got this incredible reputation, nobody's ever going to question whether you can do it at this point, right? And you've done it by being cautious and conservative.
I think that's been sort of the main difference in my style of guiding is slow, conservative choices and enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's why people come back. Mm-hmm. Now, I like to eat. I make sure my meals are tasty and delicious and nutritious all at the same time. And people enjoy that. And I take my musical instruments up there so mm-hmm. we can relax, we can sing, we can party on the mountain. I've taken my guitars to the top of every one of the continental high points. Mm-hmm. And part of the idea there is it's just like, it's not about, you know, heroism. It's about enjoyment of this beautiful world, this life, and making it the best we can.
I'm curious about when you get your clients, how you evaluate them, because obviously your trip is not going to be successful, it's not going to be safe, unless, especially for something like these mammoth climbs you're talking about, unless the people are in fantastic shape, right? So how do you sort of judge the people that you're thinking about going with?
Well, actually, that's a very excellent question, Charles. One of the things we do is we like to have a track record. Mm-hmm. So we'll start people on the easy mountains. Somebody comes to us and says, I want to do the Seven Summits. I want to climb Everest. It's very common. People just all of a sudden get the fire and the urge to go climb Everest. Great. But we want to walk you through it in a sequential way so it's safe and we know what you're capable of before we even recommend a harder mountain, a higher mm-hmm. mountain. So we'll start with a introduction course, learn the basics, how to walk mm-hmm. with crampons on, how to use your ice axe, how to avoid crevasses, how to get out of crevasse if you didn't avoid it. Mm-hmm. And so we start with baby steps, and we start people with, oh, maybe you want to climb here in the Chugach, great. We want to climb in the Pacific Northwest, excellent. We've got offerings in both places. Once they prove that they're reliable and they can take care of themselves, I mean, this is, self-care is huge.
Right.
Once we see that, then we recommend maybe you want to go to the next step.
The fitness is there, the personality is there.
Yeah, granted, you want to be a team player. You don't want people on there that are just out there for their own ego. So we check all these things out, and we actually communicate that to other guides in our company. That we have a vetting evaluation process. Hmm. So we can screen for good characteristics and screen out, you know, folks who have the wrong attitude or can't communicate, can't take care of themselves. We keep them in a level of in the beginner phase and not allow them on the bigger mountains. As they work their way up from maybe Kilimanjaro to the high point in Europe on Elbrus, they'll start thinking about bigger and bigger mountains. We like to get it four or five peaks in their belt before they have the enough experience that they're really going to appreciate what Denali's about or what Aconcagua is. And there's a financial incentive there too. You don't want to waste, you know, $6,000 going up Denali if you aren't trained. You know, if you don't know that, you know, how to take care of yourself, you can be turned back in the first week on the mountain.
Right.
So people have a financial incentive, which is good because the other mountains become more expensive. When you go to Antarctica, it's going to cost over $40,000.
Wow.
And when you go to Karstens, which is down in New Guinea, that's, you know, $20,000. So we don't want to be putting things out there for people that it doesn't serve them right. We want to give them good guidance right from the very beginning. Mm-hmm, so the screening process is very important before they ever think about getting to Everest.
Yeah, well, it hopefully it's not just some rich guy who says, I got to do this. It's somebody who actually loves the outdoors and loves the mountains. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have done a significant amount of climbing and kind of get that. Yeah. So tell me, you know, you've done all these summits and seems like you've done everything there is to do in terms of proving yourself and proving sort of your abilities, and what's there left, right? I mean, do you ever feel like you've sort of done it all, or is that just not something that's possible?
You know, you check one thing off and another one pops up. One of the things that I'd like to mention is I'd love to fly paragliders. And I was the first person to fly off the top of North America in a paraglider.
Oh, my gosh.
First person in Europe to fly off the top. First person in Antarctica. So I've got this desire. So one of the things I'd like to do is fly off the top of all seven continents. And should I be so fortunate to do that, I'd like to write a book called The Seven Plummets.
That'd be perfect.
Other things is... Now that I've done the seven summits at least 10 times each, the second highest peaks on each continent is really appealing. And it has been done by one individual that I'm aware of so far from Austria. But no one in North America has done it, or South America. And for me, that seems like a great challenge. And to pull that off, there's another book there for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So. Yeah, we had a great guest on the show who was doing the Seven Summits via sailboat without any motorized use. So he's walking, and it's like, you know, he's only got, I think, Antarctica left to go. So there's a lot of different ways to cut this cake, I guess. What do you see as the future of your sport? I mean, in terms of, we were talking about so many, you know, more people doing it. Is it still growing, and are there still... I mean, you know, first ascents are a very finite resource, you know, and even these big mountains are finite resource. Do we need to spread people out a little bit more?
I think people get it. You know, you don't want to be jammed in a camp with 1,000 people for very long. Mm-hmm. For Everest, you can maybe tolerate that. But there's literally millions of mountains out there. And fortunately, you know, Alaska's got a lot of unclimbed peaks. And I think we've got the ability to go deep and long. Uh-huh. But the sport is growing. I say sport is more of a lifestyle for some of us, but people's interest in the outdoors is much greater than it was. It's a vanishing resource. So, you know, a lot of people feel like I should go there now because it won't be that way very long. And it's true. I mean,
the way that climate change is changing the mountains. Yeah.
The mountains are, the glaciers are melting. The distances are not as remote as they once were. So, it's happening. Their drive, though, is to see it now, I think, before it changes too much. And I think we see a big upswing ever since 96, since the big catastrophe on Everest, the into the thin air situation, which I think, in a very perverse way, advertised that we could guide people to the top of Everest. Those particular people didn't have a great outcome, but many have since then. And the whole international guiding high-altitude mountains has really taken off. So we see a lot of growth, and it's given me a career, which I'm very fortunate and very thankful for. Where's it going to go? One of the big things here is weather. We have much better, much more accurate weather reports these days. For Everest, we're getting them from three different international sources. And if you coalesce those together, you can get a really good picture of what's going on. So our summit days tend to be on, you know, we go for it when the weather is available for it. And so the windows are much easier to predict now that we're getting better with. The other thing that's taken place is one of the biggest challenges is not the money that it costs to do these mountains, it's the time. And for one to become acclimatized so they can actually go to the top of Everest, it's a 45-day process.
Right.
So just recently there's been a push for people to get acclimatized before they go to Everest. And this is something that can be done with a nitrogen generator. And
wow.
Basically, you breathe more nitrogen than is normal in our atmosphere here. But it represents the proportions, percentage-wise, of how much oxygen you'd be getting at altitude. And you can work out in these low oxygen environments, and you can sleep in them, and your body can actually adjust while you're still in your home, you're dealing with your family, you're going to work every day.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, so this is something that's gonna change my classic form of guiding, which has been, you know, go there, get acclimatized, and then, you know, try for the summit. People are going to be acclimatized before they get there. It could half the length of an Everest expedition. I think you'll still need to spend some time on the ground, but you know, these helicopters bring people in. It's happening next spring. I bet there's a dozen people that fly to the mountain previously acclimatized.
Amazing.
And you know, for a business executive, it's not the money, it's the time.
Right.
And these are the kind of people that are going to push that development.
Whereas with you, you were born with an amazing body, an amazing cardiopulmonary system. Your father was an international, you know, an Olympic swim coach. All, you know, many family members were competitive swimmers. I mean, it seems like in some way you're born for what you've been doing. Did it feel that way to you? I mean, especially when I read the book, I think, wow, everything is pointing towards what he's going to do.
Well, yeah, both of my parents definitely were physical. I mean, they both majored in phys ed. But that said, I think I wasn't born, you know, able to climb. That was training.
Yeah.
And I spent 10 years of my youth competitively swimming, and it develops your cardio, it develops your lungs, it develops your ability to deal with, you know, monotony of physical endurance. And that kind of is more of a function of training in my mind.
And then becoming entranced and falling in love with Alaska. And as we've talked, you know, that big mountain that you now belongs to you, as you've climbed it more than anyone else.
Well, certainly it's everyone's, but I feel a very strong rapport with the mountain.
Yeah.
And I do feel sometimes very proud of it and very possessive. I know when I see people littering up there, it just drives me up the wall. And I'll go over and pick up their garbage right in front of them and try to embarrass them into doing the right thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, Vern Tejas. It's been really, really fun. I appreciate very much you coming in.
Thank you so much, Charles. It's a pleasure to be here on KSK.
Yeah. And check out the book, folks. It's Vern Tejas with Lou Friedman, 70 Summits, Life in the Mountains. It's available around town. That's all for our show today. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Doro, who sets up our guests. My name is Charles Wolfworth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.